So we are not applying this to any other claimant other than those who are specified under those two titles. Thank you. Are there further questions? Ms. St. Burton.
Well, in your original draft amendment, Charlie, you had Title V.
We determined that Title V is a class of federal technicians or federal civil servants, and actually they would be barred under their workman's compensation side, so it was felt it was not necessary to have that included.
I'm Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers. The present law bars anyone who has received compensation under a work comp plan. And so those people under Title V would be barred now. Really, this is simply consistent with the policy that we've already established for work comp claimants, because Title X and Title 32 are basically those kinds of systems for military.
Okay, is there further discussion on the motion on the Kopetsky amendment? Is there any objection to Representative Kopetsky's amendment? If not, it's adopted. Representative Kopetsky?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2285 as amended to the full committee first to the floor. And finally, with a due pass recommendation, I'm not sure. I guess I'll have to be fair enough.
We will so request. Representative Kopetsky moves House Bill 2285 as amended to the floor with the recommendation that it be passed and further that it be printed and engrossed. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dunn?
Aye.
Burton?
Aye.
Phil?
Aye.
Kopetsky?
Aye.
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye. Phillips? Aye. Springer? Aye. Motion's adopted. We will contact Representative Shipwreck to see if he wishes to carry the bill. He's the original prime sponsor. If he does not or other arrangements are necessary, the chair will consult and designate another carrier. Okay. 2468. Council?
Chairperson, this bill deals with the collection of state debts, such as AFS public assistance, and for recovery of costs for juvenile training schools in Canada. The proponents of the bill feel that it's inappropriate for the state to collect debts before an adjudication of the debt is made. There are several amendments to the bill. We have in front of you a copy, a hand gross copy from Sherry Rogers from Legal Aid. Student Representatives Phillips, Hill, and Miller have those copies in front of them. Our other subcommittee, two members, have them from last week. And you also have testimony from Jim Hunter from SED and Larry Young from Family Law Justice.
Okay.
We still have 6 minutes for the waiting meetings and the amendments. There are no amendments. The Rogers amendments did pass the subcommittee.
Okay, I understand the matter was moved to the full committee without recommendation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Ms. Rogers, I understand that you're prepared to discuss amendments that would deal with the Ways and Means impact and perhaps resolve a lot of the issues that may be the subject of some controversy.
For the record, I'm Terry Rogers from Legal Aid in Portland. Let me first make a recommendation to the committee that I think might simplify the discussion. The bill has three sections. And the bill, of course, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. What I would propose to the committee today is that the committee act by passing only Section 6 of the bill with some deletions in it, and Section 7. The Section 6 of the bill would have the juvenile courts make a finding of financial responsibility basically at the dispositional hearing when the family is before the court. It would also include in the summons that brings the family and the child before the court a notice that they may be responsible to pay. At the present time, the juvenile court matters are all handled separately from the finding of financial responsibility. Many times it is months and months down the line when a state debt has been accumulating, when the state is paying for the child in McLaren or foster care or wherever. And then Support Enforcement Division begins a new proceeding for a finding of financial responsibility, and the parent may well owe all the way back to the time that the parent was originally before the court because of the child. Section 6 would have it all handled in one proceeding in the juvenile court. We would need to eliminate the language on page 4 of the bill, lines 15 through 17, because that language deals with McLaren. Which, and
okay, give me those numbers again.
Okay. We would, on page 4 of the mock-up, the May 15th mock-up, I think the committee would need to delete lines 15 through 17, because that makes an exception for the juvenile training schools, McLaren and Hillcrest, and the camps, that there would be no financial responsibility in that situation. Now, I am not, of course, coming away from my own belief in the proper policy, but if we're going to eliminate retroactive state debt and eliminate parental responsibility for the juvenile training schools, there's no question that the bill has to go to Ways and Means. And I do not think that we would be able to get it out of Ways and Means this session. I do not feel that the part dealing with having the juvenile court handle the finding of financial responsibility needs to go to Ways and Means. I think it would make sense to lift the subsequent referral. I do not think it has a fiscal impact. The other portion of the bill that I think we should keep, again, because it makes good policy sense and has no fiscal impact, would require, and that's Section 7, that the Children's Services Division in voluntary placement situations give a notice, both oral and followed by a written notice, of the fact that the parent is going to be financially responsible. Section 8 would then be eliminated if it would conform other statutes to a possible McLaren change. That would be my recommendation. I did speak to Larry Young, the Attorney General, about his position on just this segment. He is still opposed.
Okay.
Well, if I may add one more thing to the committee.
Okay. Ms. Young, why don't you come up and take a seat?
Mr. Linden. Mr. Linden from the State Court Administrator's Office did testify before the committee, the subcommittee, and said that there are a number of juvenile court judges who agree that this should all be handled in one proceeding that he had heard from.
Okay, before we hear from Mr. Young, let's see if there are any questions about the nature of the amendments. Where the bill is reduced to the form now advocated by Ms. Rogers. Representative Burton.
And I just asked what may be the obvious question, Ms. Rogers, but why are you advocating this reduction? Why are you doing this?
Okay. I think it is more important to try to at least make this improvement for people to be able to be informed at an initial hearing, at the dispositional hearing in juvenile court, that that is enough of an improvement that it is worth proceeding with the legislation. Otherwise, there's no question in my mind that the bill needs to go to Ways and Means and that we would not be able to get it out of Ways and Means. We would lose it altogether.
Okay. Any further questions from Ms. Rogers about the amendments or the scaled-down bill she's proposed today? If not, Mr. Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Lawrence Young, Chief Counsel of the Family Law Section of the Department of Justice. First, I'd like to comment on Ms. Rogers' last statement. If the only reason to pass this bill is so that people can be informed early that they have a support obligation, you don't need to pass this bill. You can simply pass a law saying that any summons issued by the juvenile court will contain a notice stating that people may be required to support their children if they're in CSD care, custody, or control. That takes care of that problem. You don't need this bill. Secondly, Ms. Rogers' amendments are for the purpose of avoiding a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I will admit that her amendments do make a significant difference in the fiscal impact. It reduces the impact from $816,000 this coming biennium to $312,780. And for the 87-89 biennium, it reduces the overall impact from $1,264,000 down to $667,230. I'm using Department of Justice figures on that, but I've compared the Department of Justice figures with those figures produced out of legislative, fiscal, and exec department. The same figures were used on both fiscal analysis. So we're still talking about a bill with a $312,000 impact.
May I interrupt at that point? I haven't studied the fiscal impact recently, but and I don't want to make this sound too value-laden, but maybe I'm interpreting this incorrectly, and let me know if I am, but it seems that the fiscal impact sort of relates to the how much, quote, due process you provide or how you choose to give that. Is that basically how I'm interpreting? In other words, the more due process or the more opportunity you give a party to object or to have an opportunity to have their position considered by the court, does that mean less income to the folks that you represent, basically?
Mr. Chairman, not at all. The $312,000 fiscal impact is coming out of two things, one of which is an issue that needs to be resolved by the committee if this amendment is adopted. What happens to state debt on all CSD cases if you adopt this amendment? Currently, right, cases are heard under the SED administrative process, and there is a provision for requiring a parent to pay for the care of the child based upon the parent's ability from the date care was started until the date care ends. It's unclear whether this bill would authorize the court to do the same thing. I would submit that unless the legislature clarifies this or this committee clarifies it, that we're not going to be seeing state debt in any of the orders. Hence, you have a fiscal impact right there of $191,820 this coming biennium, and a fiscal impact of $546,270 in the next biennium. The reason it jumps from this biennium to next biennium is because, practically speaking, we don't collect a lot of state debt on the first 2 years an order is entered. The parent is busy paying the current support, but then the child goes out of care, and then you're able to catch up on what was previously owed after the child goes out of care. That's why there's the big jump. The second issue involves the timeliness with which the support order is established. Ms. Rogers has made a big point of saying the juvenile court is going to establish these orders a whole lot quicker than the support enforcement division. I flat out think that's wrong. And the reason I think it's wrong is because right now, the support enforcement division gets an automated computer referral from the children's services division. As soon as we know where the parent is, we serve the parent, and we move to establish the support obligation. Plus, we go back for state debt. The juvenile court is not going to be any faster in that, and I would submit in some cases it's going to be slower in that juvenile court only issues summonses typically to parents that are found in state. If the parent is out of state, a non-custodial parent typically in a divorce situation, typically you don't have a summons going to that parent. And so you wouldn't have that parent necessarily being required to pay. There are three other issues that have to be resolved or should be at least considered by this committee before the amendment is adopted. I'll be happy to go into those at any point. Ms. Rogers wanted to speak.
Okay, well, I'm not sure how much attention the full committee has to give to these issues for a full-blown discussion this afternoon. Ms. Rogers, do you want to try to respond briefly? And Mr. Young, how long do you anticipate it would take to permit you an opportunity to present your discussion on those three other issues?
3 to 4 minutes.
Okay, well, let's give it a try here. Ms. Rogers, do you want to respond at this point?
I think the fiscal impact statement is put together wrong for this section. We are not changing in the remaining parts of the bill language dealing with state debt. So that I don't see how they can attach an additional fiscal impact. This is basically making a procedural change, and I think that there are actual savings that will occur. Because 95% of the parents are before the juvenile court, so that in fact an order will be made. It will not contain a retroactive amount. They will begin paying promptly. It will be within their ability to pay. I think that in fact you're going to be able to get more payments from people rather than as many defaults as you get under the present system. So I don't buy the fiscal impact with the remaining sections of the bill at all.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you can eliminate the fiscal impact question on state debt by making an amendment to the bill. Section 6 of this bill was drafted with Section 1 and 2 in mind, and when you take away 1 and 2, I think you have to make some corresponding changes to Section 6. You just can't take Section 6 standing by itself. This committee could say that the juvenile court is empowered to order state debt, and you can, to a degree, remove this fiscal impact. Number one biggest objection, the subcommittee asked that Ms. Rogers and I go off in a corner and try and come up with some language that we could agree upon. And to a large part, we did without conceding that we would go for the bill. But one thing we did not agree upon, and in fact didn't really discuss, and that's found just above line 15 on page 4 of Ms. Rogers' latest draft. It says, the Children's Services Division shall be responsible for providing financial information which the court may require. What we're having is a juvenile court proceeding. The parent has all the financial information. The parent knows what's going on. Yet this bill requires that CSD is responsible for providing the information. Ms. Rogers told me the reason that language is there is because Mr. Linden insisted upon it. He didn't want the juvenile department or the judge being responsible for obtaining the information. CSD in a juvenile hearing can't ask the obligor questions. They need an attorney there. If I have to provide an attorney out of the family law section for each of these juvenile court cases, I can tell you the fiscal impact is going to go sky high, and there's a reason for that. Right now, when we do support cases in front of the courts, we schedule 15 to 30 cases for a setting to go from 2 to 4 hours. On these CSD cases, they're handled up one at a time on a dispositional basis. It's a full-blown hearing to determine what should be done with the child. I have to have an attorney there to be ready to answer the questions on support and ask the questions of the obligor. How much can you pay? This sort of thing to determine the parent's ability to pay. If I have to have a parent or an attorney sitting out at juvenile court, it's going to be at least one full-time position for Multnomah County, and probably more than that, and a lot of time in all the other counties in the state. We're talking about 36 counties. That's going to cost a lot of money, and I'm going to need additional FTE attorneys if we're going to cover it. If the court's going to be responsible for asking the questions, then that's a problem that can be resolved.
May I respond? There is a misconception here. The court can ask the questions in terms of establishing financial responsibility. This is a question of pay stubs and that kind of thing, and they will have been on notice that they have to bring them. Both CSD and juvenile court counselors now use a form to get financial information. This is pre-court that a form should be filled out in terms of the financial information about the family. That's all.
Bill requires that CSD be responsible for providing information. CSD has no way to compel a parent to fill out a form. And as long as you place the burden of proof the way the language is written, then CSD is in a very hard spot. They're not going to be able to ask questions without an attorney, and they'll have the burden of proof.
Okay, let me ask Ms. Rogers, when that language is in there, what's your intent? Is that to require CSD to provide information about the parent's financial situation, or it could be interpreted, but correct me, to actually advise the court in terms of what the real cost, quote, to the state is to provide their substitute care?
The intent is to provide the court, if possible, with information about the parent's finances, because in fact the parent is to be ordered now pay according to the parent's ability to pay, not according to the cost to the state of care. The final finding, if the parent shows in either the SED proceeding now, Support Enforcement Division proceeding, or what we are envisioning before the juvenile court, is a finding on the parent's ability to pay, even though though the current system starts out with a form that says you must pay, you owe the state $8,000, and that's been accumulated at $1,177 a month, which is what the state says it costs to keep a kid at McLaren.
Okay, well, Mr. Young, you had a couple other issues you wanted to raise.
Yes. Ms. Rogers is advocating the keeping of Section 7. Remember, she said the principal purpose of this bill is to make sure that people are informed about the support obligation. Well, if you adopt Section 6 requiring every summons to say that the parent is going to be required to pay support, then you don't need Section 7 because the parent's already informed. That's the theory of Section 6. She's now saying that it's voluntary in Section 7. I don't read it that way, and I think, in fact, what you'll find is that CSD shall provide oral notice, starting on line 41 of page 4, and CSD is required also to provide written notice, also on line 41. That's not voluntary, that's mandatory, and there's a penalty involved. It says if that notice is not given, CSD does not have the right to receive child support for the children in custody of the division in lines 6 and 7. And then there's also the attached language, until such time as notices pursuant to subsection 3 of this section have been given. This is ridiculous. The reason it's ridiculous is because you can have a situation where the parent has been given a summons, hauled into juvenile court, the judge has entered an order of support, parent at a later date, after the child is out of CSD custody, can turn around and say, I did not receive oral notice, I did not receive written notice, I don't owe CSD a dime. You don't need Section 7 if you're going to adopt Section 6. It's flat out unnecessary.
Okay, Ms. Rogers, would you like to respond?
Yeah. Line 34 of page 4, ORS 418015, pertains to the voluntary placement of children with the Children's Services Division. This is not pursuant to any summons whatsoever. These are parents where this is an aunt who can't take care of a child, single parent, the mother's in the hospital. This is the kind of situation that the aunt walks into Children's Services Division and says, I can't care for this child, would you? They say, fine. Let me change my example. The mother is about to go into the hospital and she walks into Children's Services Division and says, please take the kids or the kid is going to be on the street. They say, fine and dandy, goodbye. They don't say, you will be financially responsible. And that's what we're trying to achieve here, that when people are having a discussion about voluntary placement, that Children's Services Division workers must tell them orally and then followed by written notice that indeed they're going to have to pay. This is a factor. Children's Services Division workers like to pretend it isn't a factor because they don't want it to influence parents. They want always the best thing to happen for the child. But we feel that it is extremely important to have people advised of what's going to happen, and that is what this is about. And this happens all the time. So this is a separate proceeding, and it isn't in court yet, and that's where we want some oral notification.
Mr. Chairman, contrary to Ms. Rogers' assertion, there are very few voluntary placements where there is not a subsequent court order. So the situation I proposed earlier is that there is going to be a court hearing, even on voluntary placements. They will be served with a summons, and order will be entered. Turning to my next point, what is the effect of a prior divorce decree? Mandatory language in Section 6 requires that there be a hearing. Okay. It says, after a hearing on the matter, the court shall require the parent or other person legally obligated to support a child in the middle manner and order. Question, what happens when the parents have previously been divorced and there's a divorce order sitting out there requiring, say, father to pay $150 a month? Now, is that order valid or not? Under the language of this bill, the court has to enter an order for a kid in CSD custody. The bill, as I don't think that's Ms. Rogers' intent, but the bill as it's drafted does that. It raises a legal question whether or not the court has to go in and order a parent to pay support, even though there's a prior existing support order. If you're going to pass the bill, I think that language needs to be clarified and corrected. That's basically the comments that I have, Mr. Chairman. I have a few other minor problems.
Other than that, it's okay.
Other than that, it's just fine.
Okay, well, Ms. Rogers, I appreciate what you suggested here, and I appreciate the fact that parties, I'm sure, have made every reasonable effort to try to reach a compromise. It may be that that's not possible in each and every case. I think the problem we have is that I don't think Mr. Young is about to retire from his position, that in fact even the amended version has a fiscal impact. And in light of that position, I don't think this committee or any other committee is going to drive over that fiscal impact statement or Ways and Means Committee. Now, I would be more than glad if the majority of the committee wants to take this back to subcommittee and see if there's any possible resolution of those issues. But at this point, I just don't sense that we're prepared to cut the baby in half, and I think that's possibly the best thing we could do here, and I don't know that that's acceptable to any of the parties. That's my sense of it at this point. If someone can suggest a way out of the situation other than that, that's acceptable to all, I'd be glad to hear it.
Sounds reasonable to me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burton?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Young did recommend or had a suggestion at the beginning that we perhaps could just write into law a requirement to be placed on summons for notification. And I don't know whether that would help get Ms. Rogers towards what she needs to do or not. But if you want to, I don't know if you want to entertain trying to carry this over, if you just want to, if it isn't fixable at this point, we don't fix it. But that was one glimmer of light I saw on that.
Okay. Let me ask Representative Kavetsky and Council, this came from Sub 2, did it not? What does Friday's Sub 2 agenda look like?
Fairly heavy for Friday afternoon, Mr. Chair, but it might be time on Tuesday.
Okay. Well, unless there's a strong objection, why don't we reschedule this for work session on Tuesday? And that's kind of, that's, I think, the best way out of the situation at this time. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Representative Kapetsky, are folks still working on 2256?
No. But they're not here.
But they're not here. Okay, well, why don't we hold that for a bit? Senate Bill 573. Members will recall that this is a bill which has come to us from the Senate, and there's been continuing discussion about the definitions, and as we got a little bit closer to the bill, some people were even questioning why we needed the bill at all. The chair appreciates those concerns. However, upon further reflection, since this came from the Senate committee, or at least was sponsored by the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Forestry, I'm not sure if it came from that committee. It may very well have, and my Senate staff measure analysis indicates that it did. The chair, in conversation with council and informally with a couple members, thought it might be best to reward the House Agricultural and Natural Affairs Committee with this bill and report the bill to the floor with a recommendation that it be re-referred to committee where we know Representative Hill is a member. And Representative Miller, are you also on the Ag Committee?
I served on that
last session. Well,
right.
Representative Bellamy, you're on that committee also, aren't you? I realize you may want to declare a possible conflict on this vote, but we thought that this issue is one that probably belonged before the Ag Committee rather than the Judiciary Committee. There's certainly more expertise down in that committee as it relates to cutting and transporting logs or trees or what the documentary evidence is required, and the chair certainly would feel comfortable with that kind of action.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I would move to re-refer House Bill 573 to the Committee on Ag and Natural Resources.
Okay. Representative Bellamy has moved that our committee reports Senate Bill 573 to the floor with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources.
You don't want to just loan it to them for 10 days, Mr. Chair, under one of the House rules?
Well, relating to forest products, there may be a need. We want that bill in this committee, but I I think I feel more comfortable in entrusting it to them without loaning it to them. Okay, is there further discussion on the motion? Representative Miller?
I intend to support the motion to refer to the Agriculture Committee to where this bill really has its roots.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the motion to report and to re-refer 573 to Ag and Natural Resources? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Bill.
Aye.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Phillips.
Aye.
Aye. Motion's adopted. Representative Hill, would you like to carry this personally down to Ag and Natural Resources? Assuming the motion is passed on the floor, we'll give you the original bill to carry. Okay, do we like to make sure we have everyone here for that, if that's possible?